couldn't sleep anyway. The hole you left is full of rain. This topic this week, week seven, is on race, crime, the law, and civil unrest. Four main questions are going to be addressed through this lecture. Firstly, how does race come to be linked to crime and disobedience? This shouldn't be an obvious link, really, to make. Secondly, how have the relations between black and ethnic minority communities and the police been constructed over time? Thirdly, how have different governments over time and the police dealt with this link that's been constructed between race and crime? And lastly, what are the implications for issues of race and justice today? And in the next few slides, I'm just going to take you through just a few pictorial representations of the various topics that are going to come up. So firstly, the issue of racist policing, harassment by the police, deaths in police custody, and failures to prosecute racist attacks and murders. We're going to look at perceptions about black or youth culture, which often go together, and the link to crime in public discourse. We're going to look at the link between protest and race and crime. The whole topic of institutional racism, where that comes from and what that's all about. And the issue of, taking us right up to date, of anti-terrorism and racial profiling. So these are some of the topics that are going to come up again as we go through the lecture. Just a few facts and figures. While obviously there's a lot of moral panic about the relationship between ethnic minorities and crime, they are actually more likely to be the victims of crime. Firstly, if you look here, in the UK, whereas 25% of the white and black populations are likely to be victims of crime in general, Indians, Pakistanis and Bangladeshi people are more likely at 27 and 29% respectively to be the victims of crime. And while 0.3% of white people are likely to be the victims of racially motivated offences rather than crime in general, 2.2% of black people and 3.7% of Indians and 4.3% of Pakistanis and Bangladeshis are likely to be the victims of racially motivated crime. So in other words, a Bangladeshi is 14 times more likely than a white person to be a victim of a racially motivated offence. Stops and search, arrests and sentencing. In 2001 to 2002, and unfortunately statistics haven't been updated since then, which is an issue in itself, of 714,000 stops and searches recorded by the police, 12% were of black people, who actually make up only 1.8% of the population, 6% were Asian, who are 2.7% of the population. Black people, in other words, were 8 times more likely to be stopped and searched than white people. In 2000 to 2001, arrests of black and Asian people rose by 5 and 8%, while those of white people arrested fell by 2%. So black people were 4 times more likely to be arrested than white people. And again, it would be very interesting to see the more updated statistics about how perhaps Asian people have been targeted more in the aftermath of 9/11, 7/7, and so on. So in June 2000, ethnic minorities accounted for 19% of the male prison population, 12% were black and 3% Asian, and 25% of the female prison population, they're 19% black and 1% Asian. According to an academic survey published in December 2002, black people are 6 times more likely to be sent to prison than white people, and more likely to be imprisoned for first offence. Lastly, almost a quarter of the 72,416 strong jail population came from an ethnic minority background, with black prisoners accounting for 15% of the total prison population. So those are just a few facts and figures just to kind of set in context what we're talking about. Okay, so a word about the historical background to the, you know, the discursive link that's made between race and crime. So despite those facts and figures that we've just seen, there is a notable tendency among the general public to view minority ethnic groups, particularly black people, and today I think Muslims, as being more inclined to commit crime. And this has a historical precedent. As far back as the 19th century, there were discourses which linked immigrants, particularly in the British case, historically Jews and Irish people, to crime. In an article from, I think, 2006, Maleha Malik makes the link between race, crime, and political activism, which is something that you'll see coming up in a few slides down. She shows how Jewish immigrants, some of whom were members of Bolshevik or anarchist groups in the 19th and early 20th centuries, faced the same type of suspicion faced by many Muslims today associated with terrorism. You can see this is a group of anarchists from the 19th century. So in general, race, or otherness, if you like, has always been linked to crime. In the 19th century, the eugenics movement advocated sterilization of the poor and working classes, who they saw as feeble-minded and racially weak. And this weakness that was seen as racial in character was seen by eugenicists to lead to criminal behavior. Now, following World War II, the idea that immigrants and non-white people are synonymous with crime grew in British popular perception over time, particularly from the late 1960s on. The idea was nurtured very much by politicians, especially Enoch Powell, who we spoke of in regards to immigration. But it was also promoted by the police, who gradually began to identify black culture with crime. So where is the emphasis until the 1990s was mainly on African Caribbean people? And this is a photo that comes up on Google if you type sort of race and crime. This is kind of what comes up, right? This has changed more recently to include Asians and other non-white migrants as well. Illegal immigrants and asylum seekers, as we have seen, are often associated with crime and terrorism. And this can be seen in statements made recently about, there was a revelation, I think, about a year ago, that 5,000 so-called illegal immigrants were allowed to work in security jobs in the UK. So there's immediately a kind of association that these people are going to be threatening us simply because they're immigrants. Okay, so despite the fact that I'm saying that there is this strong discursive link made between race and crime, this hasn't always necessarily been the case. Paul Gilroy talks about this in his book, which I think is the reading for this week. He says that although since 1945 there have always been fears about the link between crime and immigration, criminality was not as racialized as it had become by the 1970s. So we need to look at why this is the case. Before the 1970s, politicians like Enoch Powell tried to establish a link between non-white immigrants and the rise of crime. So Powell was portraying this picture of Britain as being crime-free before, you know, immigrants came along. But there were other people competing with Powell, who, as we saw, was, you know, demoted from his position, who looked at other factors that may have been responsible for breakdowns in law and order. Now, the Notting Hill riots of 1958 involved actually white people attacking black people in the Notting Hill area because they were perceived to be involved in crime and in bringing disrepute to the area. But although some local residents of Notting Hill had a negative impression of blacks, it wasn't actually as widely shared and wasn't endorsed by the government. So just to get us started, a little clip from which explains what happened at the time in Notting Hill in 1958.
Something new and ugly raises its head in Britain. In Notting Hill Gate, only a mile or two from London's West End, racial violence. An angry crowd of youths chases a Negro into a greengrocer's shop. while police reinforcements are called out to check the riot, one of many that have broken out here in a few days. The injured victim, a Jamaican, is taken to safety. But the police have not been able to reach all the trouble spots so promptly, and the quietest street may flare up at any moment. The most disturbing feature of the riots is the suspicion that not all the troublemakers are locals. Some of the gangs who break windows or throw bottles or burning torches have arrived by car. Opinions differ about Britain's racial problems, but the mentality which tries to solve them with coshes and broken railings has no place in the British way of life. This violence is evil, and the law and public opinion must stamp it out.
Okay, so the discourse is quite interesting in itself. You know, this has no place in British public life. So the greatest responsibility that was seen as being behind the tensions in Notting Hill was put down to youth in general and social deprivation. Notting Hill at the time was quite a rundown area where drugs and prostitution were prevalent. It's also important to look at the role of the far right, which is what was being alluded to here in the film when they said outsiders were possibly responsible. Definitely the far right was involved in kind of coming into this area, which was heavily populated by African Caribbean people, and kind of stoking up violence. In comparison, just to this event in 1958, the presence of the National Front in Oldham and Bradford during the 2001 riots, so 40-50 years down the line, was underplayed, particularly by the judiciary, and was reflected in the harsh sentencing that many of the rioters received, up to 5 years for throwing stones and bottles. So we see the kind of shift in the way that these things were thought about. Okay, so although Notting Hill sparked discourses that linked black people to criminal behaviour, especially violence, drugs and prostitution, care was taken by the government and the police not to endorse this view. Various reports published in the 1970s showed that crime was more prevalent in certain areas and neighbourhoods than among particular ethnic groups. In the 1950s, I should say. But this was seconded by many police officials. But this changes radically by the early 1970s. So the shift really from 1958, beginning of the 60s, a decade on, we have a completely different discourse coming in. Now, this was due to a number of factors, including the economic recession of the 1970s, the success of the National Front that we spoke about before, and the impact of Enoch Powell's ideas, who certainly can't be discounted. So there were growing anxieties in the 1970s about three things: black youth culture, mugging, and the increase in black political activism. And what we want to look at now is how these three were linked in the public discourse. Now, since the arrival of non-white people in Britain after 1945, African Caribbean people in particular were seen as creating a disturbance. Parties and informal clubs, prostitution and drugs were seen as problems that black people were more prone to than whites. Now, you remember last week we spoke about this idea of a weak culture and so on. This is the kind of thing that also being alluded to here. But until 1976, these things weren't actually purely and only identified with black culture. And it was understood in the general public, in the kind of rhetoric that we saw in the little film, that not all immigrants were associated with crime or antisocial behaviour. But this more benevolent attitude all changed during the so-called long hot summer of 1976. And I've just put, I don't have time to show it in the lecture, but a very nice little film about that event on Study Direct, which you can watch later on. So in 1976, the Notting Hill Carnival, which actually began, by the way, in response to the 1958 Notting Hill riots. That's when the carnival started, because in order to, you know, deal with the problem in the area. So, but in 1976, a riot occurred during the carnival. Paul Gilroy sees this as a watershed that changed the nature of conflict between black people and the police. Leading up to this were a number of smaller riots in various parts of the country, so just to show that it wasn't necessarily an isolated event. And these riots were really the result of what was seen as the growing heavy-handedness of policing against two things. Firstly, what were seen as being black militants, so basically anti-racist activists who were very much inspired by the black power movement in the US and its instigation also in this country, and a whole different set of activities around dance halls and clubs, where many young black people, but young people in general really, were going out. So most of the incidents took place at reggae music gigs or at dance halls. Most of the riots took off in response to police trying to arrest one person at a club or something like that, or perhaps a small group of people. And what would happen is that the crowd, in response to the police attempting to arrest this person, would kind of weigh in to protect, you know, the person who was being arrested. Now, as Paul Gilroy says, clubs such as, and he names them, the Metro Youth Club, the Swan Disco, and the Burning Spear Club in London, Birmingham, and Leeds, have gone down in black British history for the confrontations that took place there with police and where many people were arrested. Gilroy says that the growing number of incidents involving black youths and the police led to the perception in society generally that there was something about black people that made them more prone to violence. We already heard this last week. Because black people identified strongly with each other and went to help other people while they were being arrested, which I don't think is a particularly black thing to do. It was young people together in a club. This is what Gilroy says, but my take on it would be, you know, young people together in a club, guy comes in, police comes in, tries to arrest one of them, they're obviously going to say, oh, we're not just going to leave our mate, you know, we're going to try and do something here. But this kind of crowd behavior, as it was seen, led to the public perception being that all young black people were violent, okay? From their side, so from the young people's side, because policing of dance halls and gigs seemed to be targeting young black people in particular, that many of them believed that they had the right, or indeed the duty, to defend themselves as a group against the police. Now, in response to the 1976 riots, the Metropolitan Police in London especially took a new approach. Before, they tended to not necessarily link race and crime, but now they put it into their policy, if you like, to see crime as being more prevalent among black people than among the rest of the population. And mugging was their big sort of axe to grind, if you like. It was believed in general society that most muggers were young black males. As Gilroy shows, the statistics used to back up these claims were actually quite shaky. In general, it was only the victim's perception of who his attacker was that led to the idea that more blacks were involved in violent thefts and muggings. Because the idea that blacks were more likely to be muggers had spread so widely through the general discourse and through the media, many victims identified their attacker as being black, whether or not this was the case. So whether maybe they didn't see the person, came up from behind and grabbed their handbag and ran on, or perhaps was wearing a balaclava or something, but they would nonetheless believe that the person was black, whether or not they'd seen their face. As Paul Gilroy and Stuart Hall both point out, it has become commonplace, and I quote Gilroy, to see the history of mugging as the history of just such a racial category of crime. The 1970s saw the cementing of an image of young black people as both hedonistic, so mad party animals, and dangerous, and in general as being completely out of control. From their point of view, young black people saw the police as intervening on behalf of white society, rather than in respect of a law that should treat everybody the same. In other words, a division was made between white culture, which was seen as being embodied by the state and its institutions, and black culture, which was seen as being alien to that white culture and existing in some kind of sphere beyond the law. The role of the police is now perceived as being to maintain these divisions and define who is on the right side of the law and who isn't. For many young black people, after 1976, this dividing line became one which separated whites from blacks. I want to make a connection to some more recent discourse on this idea of black-on-black crime and, you know, the way that's linked to gun crime and knife crime. The recent spate of killings, often of very young people over recent years, is of course big news, as it should be. But although not all of the youths involved have been black, there has been a tendency to associate gun crime with young black people. So we have to ask why this is. Few issues that have been brought up by various writers on this. Firstly, music. In the 1970s and 1980s, it was Rastas, reggae music, and dance halls that were seen as combined with mugging and violent street crime. Today, it's rap, hip-hop, and this so-called bling culture that is seen in, you know, the public discourse as promoting gun-toting and shooting. Now, while there are important issues to be raised about the link between gangster rap, the glorification of violence, and the responsibility of a multi-billion dollar music industry, the reduction of violence to a lifestyle problem is only part of the picture. So you can't blame everything on the music or the lifestyle. I think we can highlight two issues here. Firstly, black on black. What does that mean? Although more crimes, as we've seen according to the statistics, are carried out by white people in the UK against other white people, because obviously they're in the majority, we never talk about white-on-white crime. By talking about black-on-black crime, we promote an image of a self-destructive community that is imploding from the inside. This creates a special focus on black people as fomenters of crime that does nothing to look at the overall reasons for crime in the country as a whole. The second issue to be highlighted relates to the reasons behind gun crime. This is, I think, linked to the question of why there has been a rise in the availability of guns and the consequential murders. Despite the fact that it is illegal to possess weapons, guns are readily available. Also, educational and employment possibilities are still much lower for young black people than for any other group in the country. So there's obviously a direct link that we can draw between life opportunities and the spiral into violence. Thirdly, as we shall see, racist policing is still widespread. The police has a pretty bad track record on protecting black communities from racially motivated and other crime. And this will appear controversial, but if you read some interviews of people involved in so-called gangs and so on, they say that given the availability of guns, many people carry them for protection because they feel that they aren't sufficiently protected by the police because they live in no-go areas and so on. So this is the way the issue is being portrayed. What's interesting is how many parallels, although the discourse is different, how many parallels there is to what's happening today to what happened in the 1970s. So moving on now to the connection between race and riots or political protest. The various riots that took place around Britain in the early 1980s in places like Brixton, Toxteth and Tottenham are crucial for understanding the racialization of policing. What I want to do now is look at the subject of riots or uprisings, as they're called in the community, and how this evolves from the 1980s to the present day. How do perceptions and stereotypes about the proneness of black people and ethnic minorities to crime and protest become interlinked? And why are crime and protest not treated as two separate issues? What is the role of the police, we need to be asking, in connecting the two to each other? So how basically does race, crime, and political protest all kind of get muddled up in this one big picture?
Next one is... Dr. Brixton.
So you're probably too young to remember that, but that song from The Clash is about the Brixton riots of 1981.
Sorry.
Stop doing that. Okay. The backdrop to the riots. There were specific events that led up to the 1981 Brixton riots, and particularly the death of 13 people in a fire in Deptford. There were suspicions that the fire had been started by the far right, but it was barely reported by the media, and no one was convicted for the arson. Now, this gave black people, and you have to think about this in the kind of general kind of heavy-handed policing, the aftermath of the Notting Hill you know, riots of 1976 and so on. It gave black people the impression that their lives were cheap. So the atmosphere in areas like Brixton was tense, and the National Front was a constant presence in those areas in the 1970s and 1980s. And just this little film just shows you some of what would have been going on with the National Front in those areas, so we get a flavour of that. It's difficult to hear, so you have to listen quite... I think you get the picture. It's quite difficult to listen to. Okay, so this is the kind of atmosphere that you can imagine was very difficult to live with. Second thing that happens is the introduction of the so-called sus laws. The police in London implemented an operation called Operation Swamp 81 in April of 1981. And this was a mass stop and search operation aimed at stopping street crime, so mugging, that put the so-called sus laws into operation. Under the sus laws, it became illegal for the police to arrest anybody on the suspicion, hence sus, that they may be involved in street crime without having to have evidence against them. The majority of the people who were targeted were young black people who were almost constantly stopped and searched. I mean, always on a daily basis, maybe several times a day. The police was a constant presence in areas with a large black population. Now, the third thing that happens is that protest and crime gradually become synonymous. The riots in Brixton broke out seemingly spontaneously, but they were actually an organized political reaction to the targeting of young black people by the police and the public assumption that they were exclusively responsible for all crime. The government and the media interpreted the riots as an expression of black disorderliness and disrespect for the law, so a kind of an excuse to go looting and to, you know, cause ruckus. But in fact, they came on the back of peaceful protest marches against racist policing and tragedies like the Deptford fire, many of which had been stopped from going ahead by the police. As Paul Gilroy explains, there was actually a purposeful confusion of protest on the one hand and crime that was actually orchestrated by the police and the media. Both protest and crime, such as mugging, took place in the street, so the idea was that somehow the two were the same. Because black people were considered largely responsible for crime, their right to protest was seen as being illegitimate. If protest then turned violent, it was obviously black people's natural, you know, inclination to violence and crime that was blamed, not the way in which protest had been handled by the police. And if you watch the film that I put on Study Direct about the 1976 riots, you can see how, to what extent the police had kind of come there for a fight. So what happens afterward, after the riots, kind of sets the tone for a lot of the way in which what's called race relations has been framed since the 1980s until New Labour comes into power. After the riots, Lord Scarman was commissioned by the government, which was a Tory government at the time, to write a report and make recommendations. And his report sets the tone, really, as I said, for British race relations for almost two decades. The important point about the Scarman Report was the way in which it compounded assumptions and stereotypes about black people and the reasons for the riots, so the stuff that we've just spoken about. Scarman recognized the disadvantage faced by many black people, so he recognized that there was unemployment, poor housing, health, and so on, and promoted the idea of positive discrimination as a means of alleviating these problems. However, while this can be seen as positive, it ignores the real reasons for the riots. Scarman didn't see the disadvantages faced by black people as systemic, as inbuilt into the structures of British society. So although he recognized that some people had racist attitudes, he didn't see racism as part of British society and its institutions. Most importantly, he ruled out the idea that the police force was institutionally racist. Instead, Scarman argued that black British children were at a disadvantage because of the structure, and we've heard this before, of black family life, emphasizing in his report the problem of single parent families. And I think you're beginning to hear things that you recognize here. Scarman pathologized the black family and makes this the problem behind the riots. On the other hand, the police were actually praised for their handling of the riots. Scarman makes no reference to the backdrop to them, so the Suss Laws and Operation Swamp 81. Instead, blacks are seen as a people disadvantaged by their culture, which is perceived, as we saw last week, to be naturally violent and immoral, and therefore in need of help from the state. Now, Jenny Bourne, in an article in Race and Class in 2001, says that the Scarman Report reduced racism to the level of the individual. Racism was seen to come from a few bad apples within institutions, such as the police, but not from the police as an institution. Racism was also seen as being the individual perception of some black people, and there could be no objective evidence for racism because, according to him, it was always subjective. Jenny Bourne claims that Scarman's proposal to create a system of positive discrimination only managed to elevate some black people out of their situation of disadvantage, which led to the creation of a black middle class that did nothing to solve the problem of systemic discrimination and institutionalized racism. So, I now want to jump forward a sort of decade and a half to the discussion of institutional racism, which, as we know, is something that today is recognized, and look at the background to the Stephen Lawrence affair, which led to the ruling, finally, that contra Scarman, that institutional racism is a factor. It took until 1999 for this to be recognized, following the inquiry into the murder of Stephen Lawrence. Now, the Stephen Lawrence murder was a landmark in British race relations history because it led, in 1999, to the finding of institutionalized racism. The McPherson Report, this time, which is the report after this inquiry, overturned the consensus established by Scarman in 1981. It found that the police and other institutions were rife with racism and that this has a direct effect on the treatment of ethnic minorities in policing, in social services, in the NHS, and a host of other public and private bodies. I don't want to go into too many details about the Stephen Lawrence affair. Many of you may be familiar with. You can find a lot of good information from the Brian Cathcart book that's there on the Study Direct in the reading list. But I'll just show you a brief clip from a film that looks into the aftermath of the Stephen Lawrence affair, after which the five people who were basically known by everybody to have been guilty for the murder were never convicted for his murder. And in this documentary, that's actually found out conclusively. So we'll just have a quick, brief look at that.
It's a spring day in 1981. Britain's most famous unsolved murder and continues to be a blot on the social conscience of the country. The killing of black teenager Stephen Lawrence 13 years ago became the unwelcome symbol of the 90s. We watched as Stephen's parents, driven by grief and a vain search for justice, took on an establishment that didn't want to listen. We watched as five white racists suspected of the killing treated the legal system with contempt. The police failed the Lawrences, and their struggle for justice was played out before us in a series of high-profile events. A trial. An inquest. An inquiry. The case was to change British attitudes to race relations, and for the first time, force the police as an institution to confront its racism. But still, no one has been convicted of committing this racist murder.
The authorities say there's not enough evidence to prosecute these men. So we launched our own investigation. We wanted to see if their alibis stand up. We found that they don't.
Okay, so if you want to find out in more detail why they don't, then you can watch that also on Study Direct. Unfortunately, we don't have time for the whole film, which is about an hour long. What I want to do now is to have a little bit more of an analysis into this whole, to have a bit more of detail into this whole idea of institutional racism. So that's the definition, which I'm not going to read out for you, but this is the central way in which institutional racism is understood post-Macpherson, so since 1999. Again, Jenny Bourne, in an article in Race and Class, identifies three main problems with this finding of institutional racism. The first comes from the definition itself. By focusing on words such as unwitting prejudice and thoughtlessness, Macpherson puts the problem of racism back onto the backs of individuals, just as Scarman did. So it's not as different from the Scarman report as people have made out. The wording of the definition of institutional racism assumes that what happens is that prejudiced individuals turn an institution into a racist one. But in fact, Bourne argues, the opposite is the case. When an institution is racist, then individuals who work in it express the structural racism of the institution. The second problem is in the proposals that Macpherson makes for coping with institutional racism. Many people interpreted the report to mean that the staff of various institutions had to be more diverse. And as Jenny Bourne comments, there is nothing wrong with this as part of an overall strategy, but it cannot be the only strategy. Employing more minorities will not bring about a change in racist structures. For Bourne, it is more a way of warding off criticism because it is more difficult to say that the police is racist if it employs ethnic minorities. And this approach has also been criticised by the National Black Police Association. And what's most interesting is the recent claim by this association that telling ethnic minorities not to join the police force because it is an institutionally racist force. And you may have seen a documentary by the same guy who made the Stephen Lawrence one about a month back, in which he discovers the extent to which that the police is still institutionally racist. The third criticism is that talking about institutional racism is not the same as talking about state racism. As Jenny Bourne points out, at the same time as the conclusions of the Macpherson report were being responded to in the early 2000s, the government was bringing in other pieces of racist legislation in the area of criminal justice and asylum and immigration. Ultimately, it's the state and not a specific institution that causes racism to become institutionalized. The Macpherson ruling allowed the new Labour government to say it was tackling racism, while at the same time, according to Bourne, introducing new forms of legislation that targeted black and minority ethnic people. Because Macpherson didn't take a holistic approach to state racism, he failed to account for this happening. Now, despite the fact that the Macpherson report admitted institutional racism in the police force as far back as 1999, This hasn't really been taken into account. In fact, when we look at the case of the Oldham, Burnley and Bradford riots of 2001, there are many more similarities between 2001 and 1981, so 20 years behind, than what was going on in the 1990s. Arun Kundanani once again gives an excellent overview of the events of the summer of 2001. He compares the riots in the north of England of mainly Asian youth to those of Brixton in the 1980s. And what's interesting here is that whereas the response from the police was similar, the actual catalyst for the riots was very different. Whereas Brixton was the result of organized community self-defense, as we've seen, Bradford was actually totally disorganized and haphazard. While in Brixton, black, Asian, and white people protested side by side, Bradford and the other northern towns were completely segregated between whites and Asians. And if you remember last week, you'll know a little bit why that was the case. The riots in Bradford erupted in reaction to the National Front coming into the town, as I said before. Local people organized a protest against the National Front march, which was reacted to by police in riot gear. Following the riots, which went on for a couple of days, the sentencing of the people involved was extremely harsh. Even first-time offenders were given up to 5 years in prison. Tony Blair, who was Prime Minister at the time, his main emphasis in his speeches was on the thuggery of the riots. Just like the attitude 20 years before, the emphasis was on crime and violence rather than on the reaction to institutionalized racism and social exclusion. This time, the emphasis was on Muslims, although actually there were people from different religious and ethnic backgrounds involved. The perception was that the violence stemmed from Muslims and that this violence was widespread. Just like there was something about blacks that made them more prone to violence 20 years ago, the idea today is that Muslims are naturally more violent than anybody else. Which leads us on to the whole anti-terrorism issue, which is very, very current today. In many ways, the situation facing Muslims under anti-terrorism laws isn't so different from that which has faced black people and ethnic minorities in general since the late 1970s and the introduction of the SUS laws. But the situation is aggravated by the fear and moral panic created by terrorism in the post-9/11 world. Statistics show that the majority of Muslims in Britain are not, obviously, involved in terrorist activity, and neither are they implicated in so-called fundamentalist or radical politics. The fact that a small minority is, however, creates the perception, once again, that there is something about Muslim culture that makes Muslim people more prone to violence and terrorism. So we see already the similarity in the discourse of how black people were spoken about in the past. As we saw last week, the current policy puts the emphasis on culture. It therefore ignores political, social, and economic dimensions in much the same way as Scarman ignored the very same factors in making the link between culture, black culture at this point, and the riots of 1981. Anti-terrorism policy today is based on the principle of deterrent. It operates a kind of presumption of guilt until innocence is proven, rather than the other way around. And by doing so, it obviously cannot avoid using racial or ethnic stereotypes. So what are the implications of these anti-terrorism laws for racism? The most significant implication is what we call racial profiling. Although profiling actually goes against all of the recommendations made in the McPherson report, it is still used in policing against terrorism. According to David Cole in an excellent book in 2003, profiling involves, and I quote, reliance on a generalization about people of a particular group. The Prevention of Terrorism Act of 2006 allows for a person's ethnic origin to be taken into account when being stopped by the police. And if you look at section 44 of that act, it specifies Muslims. But the problem with this is that, as we know, Muslim people are not an ethnic group. So what this therefore allows police to do is to stop Asians, black people, people of Middle East appearance, and this is what is written in the act, who may or may not be Muslim. People who, the perception is, may be Muslim because there's an association between skin colour and perhaps a particular look, beard and I don't know what, and being Muslim and possibly being a terrorist. So we see already the problem with that. Obviously, this leaves out the possibility of white people being Muslim. There are many white converts to Islam. Okay, so the important thing here is that Islam is a religion, not an ethnicity. However, blacks and Asians are, as we know, 4 times more likely to be stopped under terrorism laws than white people. As David Cole points out, this very crude way of going about things actually leads to ineffective policing. The case of the so-called shoe bomber, Richard Reed, who was actually mixed race, but you know, nobody in his family was Muslim, who was able, in fact, to slip through the net and almost detonate his bomb aboard a flight, okay, because he didn't. He looked white, according to police. Okay? I actually picked up this leaflet around the university, which gives an interesting definition of your rights if you're stopped and searched. What's interesting about stop and search, which in reaction to the original sus laws is actually quite heavily legislated for, in cases of suspected terrorism, police do not have to prove that they have reasonable suspicion to search someone. So in effect, these rights are suspended when it comes to anti-terrorist policing. So your rights when you're stopped and searched mean nothing if you're suspected of being involved in terrorist activity. And the interesting thing about this is that although the police are aware that no terrorists have actually ever been caught through stop and search, they still see it as a deterrent against would-be terrorists. So basically maintaining this kind of heavy policing in certain areas and kind of making people aware that they're being watched. So what are the implications of all of this for our subject here? It's clear that rather than acting as a deterrent, anti-terrorist policing, such as stop and search, have done nothing to stop the problem. It was made clear by the Jean-Charles de Menezes shooting, the Forest Gate incident, and other high-profile cases that we're aware of. What anti-terrorist policing and racial profiling do is to create an atmosphere of fear and victimization within communities. People are actually sort of living on tenterhooks, if you like, waiting for the next police raid that could target anyone, or so the perception is, in their homes, when they go to mosque, or in the streets. Such a situation can only lead to a sense of anger and frustration that could, and this is the problem, indeed lead some people towards radicalization or violence. Okay? Racial profiling leads to a situation that's very similar to the one that we had in Brixton in 1981. People who have grudges against the police and the government, instead of, you know, which might be legitimate grudges, instead of being given the right to protest peacefully, are being immediately singled out as potential terrorists, much as young black people in the 1980s were thought of as being prone to mugging and so on. This leads to whole communities being identified as potential instigators of terrorist violence, which obviously creates a very, very difficult relationship between the state and individuals. So, lastly, I mean, what are the implications for the rest of society? As you know, there are countless new measures that have been brought in that have a direct effect on our civil liberties as a result of all of this focus on terrorism. For example, it is now illegal to protest outside Westminster without a permit, something that you may or not be aware of. Secondly, ID cards, as we can see here, are being brought in, as I think you know, and actually students are going to be one of the first groups targeted, so get ready, you're all going to get your ID cards soon.
But actually coming in, I don't know.
Well, they've already been brought in for non-citizens, okay? And the plan now is to unveil them to the rest of the population in the next year, okay? So something that actually in this country would have been absolutely unheard of just quite a short time ago is now being accepted generally in society by many, many people as kind of, you know, something that's unavoidable. Okay, something that actually ran quite contrary to at least British attitudes to privacy and so on. And the last thing that we know is the extension of the 28-day period during which a suspect can be held without charge. There was that all of that debate about, you know, making it 42 days. The original proposal was 90 days. It didn't get through the Lords, but we haven't, you know, stopped hearing about this yet. So all of these things, as many writers have pointed out, don't necessarily think that we who are not directly affected by these issues won't in some way be affected, because we have to look at anti-terrorism policing and other types of policing as being kind of targeting one group first and then being extended to the whole population, which is what the plan is with identity cards and could potentially be the case when it comes to detention without charge. So often racialized policing is kind of the tip of the iceberg in terms of extension to the rest of the population. So it's very interesting to look at how these issues that seem to be only to do with our topic here on this course could actually be of wider implication for more general issues. Okay, so next week we'll be looking at anti-racism, so how some people have tried to work against some of these things. And I'd appreciate it if you can think about what you would like to discuss in week 10. Okay? Thank you very much.